I was going to say just three very brief things and picks up on what we've just heard discussed, because one of John and my frustrations as we've been doing this project is people come to talk to us about the social and political implications of the digital revolution, but they don't talk about that. They talk about two things. They either talk about policy in isolation, so policy outside of politics, or they talk about ethics. Or if they think they're doing joined-up thinking, they talk about the ethical implications of their policies, or they talk about the policy implications of their ethical views. And the thing that's missing is politics. And politics is, among other things, about power. And today we've heard quite a lot, I think, which is about politics, social and political implications, which goes beyond, doesn't see policy in a vacuum, doesn't see ethics in a vacuum. And part of the problem, and it was touched on earlier at various points, and it came out in Daniel's talk and John's question, when people do treat politics as though it were just ethics and policy, that has an impact on politics because people hate it. People do not like having their politics reduced to moral expertise. It may be the way we're heading, but it'll be a very bumpy political road before we get there. So I want to say three things that come out of what I've heard today in relation to this. So one is how I see how this might impact on politics. And there are three levels. It can change, if you think of politics as a game, I know it's more than a game, but if you think of it as a game, it's going to change how people play the game. It could change the rules of the game, and it might actually change the game itself. You can change the rules but still be playing the same game, or it may be that we're going to actually be playing a completely different game. So I'll just illustrate that. So how people play the game, Willie touched on this. Social democratic parties are in trouble. Parties of Labour are in trouble under these conditions. The way the game is being played in Britain at the moment, there's a little dance going on in which George Osborne is trying to rebrand the Conservative Party as the party of work, not of Labour, but of work, because he claims that he is presiding over a government which is a job creation machine. Some of that comes out of some of the trends that Willie was talking about. There are lots of political responses to that, one of which is that the jobs that are being created are not the kinds of jobs that lots of people want. And it raises questions about the value of jobs and what we mean by jobs. But that all, I think, takes place and is currently taking place within what we recognize as politics as it's been practiced for a while. What it would be to change the rules of the game would be, we still, I think, live in a world where Osborne or Obama in the United States, I mean, a lot of Obama's claim to his legacy is that he has created 15 million jobs. And we're playing politics according to a set of rules which says that that must be a good thing. And the job-creating politician trumps the job-destroying politician. But there might be a future in which the job-creating politician confronts the leisure-creating politician, which was touched on at the very beginning. That would be a very different set of rules for the game. It's quite hard to imagine, but it must be possible that discussions about are these jobs worth having turn into discussions about what value we put on jobs and how we relate that to other values. We are not playing that game at the moment. We're nowhere near it. Maybe in Finland they're experimenting with it, but you know, Finnish experiments and politics in the West are not the same thing. Or it could change the game itself. So again, Willie talked about labor unions as their disappearance has fundamentally shifted politics and reduced the options available to us. But he touched on another institution which is under threat, which is the political party. If this technology starts to eat away at political parties so that they cease to be the defining institutions of modern politics, then it's a different game. There is no modern politics without political parties. Then if we're moving into the politics, say parties are replaced by coalitions of experts, it is a different business altogether. It's, which of these things is going to happen? It seems to me that all of these levels are going to interact with each other. There is no one level at which this is going to take place. They're going to interact with each other. And the two other things I wanted to say, just illustrations of some of the ways they might interact. So another thing, I'm focusing on what Willie said because it had, in some sense, the most politics in the way that I'm thinking about it, though, of course, we heard a lot about this in the last talk as well. Willie said that one of the features of the world that we're living in is that collectivism is in retreat, which is true. So one of the effects of this is what it's doing to collective institutions. And almost everything we heard about relates to forces that are eating away or undermining various forms of collectivism. Now, if the culmination of that process is that what's happening is going to be the triumph of individualism, that is going to have a fundamental effect on politics, and it's almost certainly not going to be good. Because if individuals confront individuals, then the powerful exploit the weak. We know that. That's a world we used to live in, and it could be a world that we're heading towards. But I think it's very unlikely that it's going to be a straightforward path from collectivism to individualism, because there are lots of variations on collectivism that are going to intrude. But also it's the case that collectives are stronger than individual at the level of the weak and the exploited, but also they're stronger at the level of the employees, the wealthy, and so on. And these things are not in sync. It could be that individualism destroys collectivism at the level of the powerful more quickly than it destroys collectivism at the level of the less powerful. There must at least be possibilities along the way of this process. Consumers or other kinds of groups can form other kinds of collectives which actually have a powerful lever against the progressive individualism that's eating away any kind of solidarity among the wealthy or the rich. And this process is almost certainly going to go along in a very uneven way. I think it is the case that these new kinds of collectives, I mean, for instance, collectives are potentially more powerful than corporations, because corporations are not collective entities. Corporations can be extremely individualistic entities. But these new kinds of collectivities, whether they're networks, counterpower forms of networks, they are more transient. They are unquestionably more transient. They're quicker to form, they're quicker to break up. So this is going to be an incredibly choppy process. And as I was listening today, all sorts of other thoughts occurred to me, one of which was, say we do move into that middle phase where leisure competes with employment as a value that politicians seek to achieve, and say we move to a world in which citizens are paid an income and that they can choose how they wish to spend their time. One question is how many of them are going to choose to spend their time on politics? And some of them will. That will be their leisure activity. Some people enjoy it. And that's going to create new kinds of divisions, cross-cutting divisions in all modern societies. Does politics then belong to the people who choose it as a leisure activity? And that could happen at all sorts of different levels. I mean, you see a bit of it now. I think the Corbyn phenomenon is partly an effect of this. There's probably a bigger division in contemporary Western societies between the active and the passive face of politics than there is between different political interests. I mean, the divide within the contemporary British Labour Party is bigger than the divide between certain wings of it and other parties, because it's the divide between people for whom politics is the whole of what they're interested in, and the people for whom politics is just a functional activity. That divide could get bigger and bigger, and that could potentially change the game, because among other things, it could totally transform the nature of political parties. And then the last thing, because I know we are running out of time, then the last thing that I wanted to say was the other thing that hasn't been touched on here. So I think all of these kind of trends have been touched on, and they cut across the role of expertise, the roles of professions, because professions are collective entities par excellence, and it could be that individualism will destroy them, or it could be that we reconfigure new, much more transient kinds of professions. It could be that we move to the age of rule by experts. That has to be a possibility here. And those experts may end up being machines. I mean, all of these things, and then we are in a different game. I mean, that's the end of politics. So that's the end. The fourth possibility is the game ceases, and then we have to study something else, if we're me. But the other thing that has not been mentioned is these, from kind of shifting how people configure politics to the rules of politics to the game itself, the thing that triggers these movements are shocks. Everything that's been described today has tended to be described in terms of trends, patterns. There will be disruption, and everyone talks the language of disruption, but what people in the tech business mean by disruption is, I don't think, the same as shocks or crises in politics, not least because disruption is a good term for them, and disruption in politics is usually not a good thing on that level. There will be shocks. And the shocks are going to cut across all of these things. So the reason the future is completely unknowable is that we don't know what the shocks are going to be. The Piketty story depends on war. So if you take war out of the equation, what are you left with? I think John mentioned that two societies that do have citizens' income are Norway and Saudi Arabia, because it's built on oil. And the shocks that may be coming with old-style analog disruption to commodities, the production, the consumption of commodities, shocks that may come from environmental factors, are going to cut across these stories in ways that we can't imagine. And that will not have simply policy implications or ethical implications. That will reconfigure politics at potentially all three of those levels. And there is a tendency in all of these discussions, even ones like today, which are really not like the bubble conversations you have when you talk about these problems with people who are inside the Silicon Valley mindset. This was the opposite of that. But there is still something of a kind of, in political terms, a limit to how far we can imagine. And even in these conversations, we've all agreed that we can't imagine what the future is really going to be, which is to factor out the things that will actually shape the politics of this, say, over the next, say, if this is coming in the next 25 to 50 years. And what we have not had yet, this is a slight preoccupation of mine, what we have not had yet is the crisis or the shock of this technology yet. So we had all of these forces at work on our politics, but none of these forces have yet combined to produce the thing that would trigger fundamental political change. But if I had to make a prediction about the next 25 to 50 years, is that at some point, as well as these things operating as trends and forces that impinge on how we do politics, they will generate transformative shocks. And when that happens, then we start the discussion again. That's it.